starting off here today again. Mr. Finelli, have any questions? You do? Or just wait a second.
Yes.
No, no, that's more. Mr. Finelli, thank you.
Thank you. I really do need to get a light. I lay awake last night trying to put your experts beside two other experts and drawing the dots. So I think it really is another nightmare. So we'll try. So what I'm looking for is it's going to be difficult for you trying to do that. So. But I think your expert opinion would be useful to even though it might be your first guess at it, would be quite useful. I really want to focus on your work you did in your evidence in chief on mitigations. And with table 3, the reasonable summary of those results.
Yes.
Yeah. So the court, that's on page 307, 0176. Probably moving on from the last question from Doc, really talking about those tools in the toolbox, if you like, and your view of what constitutes a physical source area, the riparian fencing, etc. Given what we've been talking about in these proceedings, are there many tools left in the toolbox beyond those things?
Absolutely. There are a number of ways that we can protect those critical source areas. So some of those are through our grazing management practices, so we might not graze that paddock at a time of year when those waterways are flowing.
Mm-hmm.
We may graze with a lighter stock house or graze just with sheep. There are also edge of field mitigation, so a detainment bund or a sediment trap that might capture at the edge of that paddock some of the sediment and other contaminants before it travels any further. So there are a number of mitigations that can be implemented, some of them with no cost and immediately before or other than just fencing.
Okay, that probably leads on to my next question. Have you read Mr. Lowe's evidence? I'll just read one paragraph out, and at paragraph 21, mitigation methods used at a catchment level, sorry, computer's gone down, should consider the method's efficacy at a farm level. Theoretical maximums are not likely to be achieved over an entire farm, and care is needed when extrapolating to the catchment level. So, just your example of edge of field, that might be applicable to part of the farm and do wonderful things in that part of the farm, but it may not be possible to have those edge of field mitigations covering the whole farm.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I would imagine as part of the farm plan, you'd be identifying those risk areas of the farm and then identifying potential mitigations to ultimately come up with the best mitigation for that situation. And that would be part of the farm plan and management.
Yeah. Okay. So they've got specific requirements of feasibility involved.
Absolutely.
Mm. And okay, another example I might give just to try and illustrate the patchiness and incomplete nature when I look at my farm and riparian fencing, if I take account of all perennial and intermittent streams and have those fenced, which is about the situation that is in now, and look at the catchment areas behind those fences, it comes up to about 50% of the farm. But then when I look at the concentrated flow paths out of that, mainly gullies feeding higher land of that same catchment, it takes out a large proportion of that area. So really only about 10% of the farm can be effectively filtered by those fences. So that's another sort of example that you think Mr. Lowe might be looking at.
In terms of the catchment area that critical sources area is, that's converging to the critical sources area.
Yes.
Yes, so yeah. So when you are putting out a mitigation, a detainment bundle or whatever it may be, you have to take into consideration that the catchment that mm-hmm. contributes to that
yeah.
area, and that will be the amount of contaminant or
And just in my situation, there's no opportunity for the detainment fund there, just because of cost and it's just not feasible because of the landforms, the slopes, too steep, etc. So, okay, trying to sort of get a feel for what might be achievable this. Closing 20% of the gap in this first plan change and then get a feel for what's left and what's really possible. The third lead is Dr. Stubbs' book, Evidence in Chief. Have you read that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. Paragraph 1-2. We've already heard about at paragraph 1-3-4 where 60% of catchment sediment was sourced from riverbanks. The other thing that shouldn't be a surprise but was a surprise to me at paragraph 1-2-3, and I should go to that.
Can I?
Yes. Have you got a reference? Did you get?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, 301, is it? Gosh, my system's falling down here, I'm sorry. I'll have to add a little bit. He's talking about what there's natural contaminant loads versus what contaminant loads are coming off farms and point sources. So he estimates, and based on recent work just last year by his predecessor and Dr. Vic Fant, saying about a third of the current N load is due to natural processes and about half of the P load is due to natural processes. So basically, we haven't got a lot of room to move to make changes to farm practices to achieve changes in nutrient loads and streams.
Yes, I guess when we've got those contaminant loads coming from a farm, there is a background level of loss that would occur even under a natural situation. Mm-hmm. So we do need to be mindful that we're playing with that top. We can never go below that sort of background level.
So the task in front of us is made more challenging of that to achieve those levels that we target or to achieve.
Yes, well, a lot of water quality science, so it depends how much that's taken into consideration.
Okay, Okay, look, thank you for that. That's sort of confirmed my nightmare.
Thank you, Mr. Pennell. Lockie, what's going to be here today? Mr. Collins.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Holman.
Thank you, sir. I'd like to take you back to the joint witness statement that was carried out during the mediation process, I believe it was, attached to the evidence of Earl Abelco. So that's the Common Bundle, Volume 301, tab 16. And if you could go face to page 301.06.32. You have that there?
I do.
So, Mr. Conway asked you some questions about your level of comfort with using the NRIS scorecard as a gateway approach, and as I read it, this part of the joint witness statement refers to an additional use of different tools to establish baseline that says show that baselines have not been exceeded and demonstrate on-farm reductions of contaminants. And so I wanted to ask you a few questions about the use of the NRIS scorecard and overseer to do that role. And if so, if we can scroll down to your position that's noted on page 301.0633, JC, developing a tool for use as a graphing gauge is quite a different prospect to designing one that will then be used as a baseline and to determine direction of change over time. I do not feel the proposed contaminant risk scorecard should be used for anything other than as a drafting gauge, if required at all. Is that still your opinion?
I'm just going to check because I say the contaminant risk scorecard, and I want to be sure that I was talking about the nitrogen risk scorecard and not the...
Yes, certainly, take your time.
So, I think I was pretty sure that I would enter the Russian school card. I do believe it can be used for a drafting aid, and my concerns about initially were about how do we know that 20 points under a stocking rate is equivalent to 20 points under winter grazing, and that those removal of those points would have the same impact on nitrogen leaching. Having read the Abacus Bio report, that's exactly what that report, what the author of that report did, was check that the relative changes in those numbers were having a correct, you know, and so that changes my, if required at all, comment, I guess. So I am happy that it will be used as a drafting.
But you're not happy for it to be used for, as a baseline and determine the direction of change?
The concern I have with it When you have that scorecard, the only thing that you can do to alter your value is change those input values, so stock out, etc. There are other mitigations that I'm thinking, things like you could change the location on the farm of where you have your winter crop today. There are other mitigations that you could do that aren't represented in that scorecard, and therefore farmers would be penalised if they had to rely on just those inputs as ways to show that they would actually reduce the nitrogen leaching loss. It doesn't take into account the mitigation delay.
Yes, because in your evidence you talk about the importance of inherent risk factors or other experts call them the biophysical factors. And Ms. Foster's evidence is that those factors are to be taken into account through the FEP process. And if you're going to take those factors into account in the FEP process, don't you need a FEP support tool such as Overseer to support that?
Overseer is going to give you a quantification, but that's only for nitrogen.
So, with regards to the government advice, you could say use the Overseer tool, but you can use other tools as well. And in the planning provisions, basically to the C Roman number 3, there's a provision there that persons that are required, that are high risk, are required to go down to moderate or low. Can demonstrate that the particular tool does not reliably account for the benefits of contaminant mitigation measures that are in place on their farm. So you could use a policy such as that along with Overseer.
I'm not a planner, so I'm not going to talk to the policy, but Overseer very much has a role to play, but I don't think it should be the only tool. I think it is very useful information if we understand the constraints of that.
You don't think it should be the only tool, but shouldn't there be a standardised tool that's used across farms? And so shouldn't it be named as that tool, and then farms can also use another tool alongside it, and this is for the function that we discussed in the JWS of establishing baselines and showing that baselines have not been exceeded and demonstrate your on-farm reductions, so that there is consistency across farms. For that?
I think this is potentially a planning question. I'm not sure that I can help you. can you rephrase the question?
Yes. So if we go back to the JWS where you talked about the role of establishing baselines, showing that baselines have not been exceeded, and demonstrating on-farm reductions of contaminants, the proposition I'm putting is that there should be one tool that's used for that across farm systems where it can be used. That doesn't mean that farmers can also use other tools as well. argue, if you like, why that talk hasn't captured all the mitigations. But my proposition is that there should be one tool for this across dairy.
I do think that this tool is very useful in looking at a set of baseline and direction of change for a single farm. I agree, and I do think that because it has those biophysical factors, it is giving us a greater indication of nitrogen leach loss. But it was the caveat of those soil types that I mentioned. The other thought product being that the nitrogen is a soil type that you can't change your climate. Within a farm, you can get some idea of where you're going, but it's, I think it's harder to compare between farms.
Okay, thank you. I know you said you're not a planner, but currently the tool named, or the tool named to do that in the Beaverland Federated Farmers version is the nitrogen risk scorecard. And I think you've said that's not an ideal tool for the purpose. No, to establish baselines, show they have been exceeded, and then primarily actually to demonstrate reductions of contaminants.
Yeah. For nitrogen leaching, it's my professional opinion that overseer, the dairy and the microcatro, with the caveats across those soil types, then could possibly farm them. So we'd be looking at free drain soils.
Thank you. Just returning to the gateway for a moment, the proposition is to use, still I think, is to use the endless scorecard gateway alongside the nitrogen leaching risk. NLLR gateway. They're not directly comparable because the EMA scorecard, I think, has been established, doesn't take into account the inherent risk factors which can form quite a high proportion of your assessment of risk of end loss. Should not, if you're having a gateway like that, is this a planning question possibly, should not they be comparable?
I think about this with two different hats. One is a purely scientific board, and the other is a practicality. And the practicality is that there's a large number of farmers that have to do this. The overseer costs $740, including GST, plus a consultant to do that. The nitrogen risk scorecard, my understanding is that it will be developed a portal or something on the website, like the Regional Council, that you can put that data in. I strongly suspect that your highest and your lowest are the guy that's going to actually be able to make farms, and it's those people that are on the cusp that may flip. But in general, it's going to identify those. And so for the cost and the angst, I do believe that for a drafting gate, the nitrogen risk scorecard, as well as overseer, is actually probably the pragmatic.
Could you deal with that by saying that you could do a first cut on the nitrogen risk scorecard to identify the lowest, and then the middle and the high would need to go through the overseer after that?
I think that's
okay. Right. Do you have the Federated Farmers Beef and Lamb version of the planning provision? If you can turn to Roll 3, 11, 2.4.
3, 11, 2.4.
Yes.
Moderate intensity. Thank you.
On page 28. And subclause under spirits control activity subject to the following conditions. Subclause 3, a nitrogen risk scorecard assessment is undertaken or a nitrogen leaching loss rate is produced to the property and records are kept in accordance with Schedule B. So the other issue with the overseer versus the end of the scorecard is what records are required to be kept. And have you turned your mind to the utility of keeping records according to one more comprehensive tool such as overseer, which takes into account phosphorus to an extent, versus allowing only records to be kept based on the endless scorecard, and potential utility with having consistent records across the sector?
No, I haven't thought about the different records. I guess those biophysical factors are actually going to be reported in the farm plan, and so a lot of those inputs, either the abuses,
now, I'd like to change topics, please. Oh, just one more topic on the overseer issue. Mr. Conway raised with you the issue about version changes of overseer.
Yes.
And what's your opinion? Because my first proposition is that good models would consistently improve over time. And secondly, my understanding is that usually occurs in the first part of model development, and there was a large change between the versions 5 to the version 6, is my understanding. And you have already commented on this to an extent, but you wouldn't expect, would you, such a large change in the future?
No, I wouldn't. And where it may be different would be farm systems where they might have crops or pasture species that aren't ryegrass, or they've got some decommissioned plants, because that's sort of where, you know, we're developing new things where beforehand you might, a plantain might just be considered as ryegrass when doing data input. So those sorts of things, as that data is available, there will be changes, so farm systems that are incorporating those potentially in the future. What OverseerCare does is it retains all your information from the previous years, and it actually, when the model changes, it changes the whole lot. So you're not comparing the investment council takes it off the website and keeps it static. The farmer is actually able to compare from 5 years ago to current with the version change occurring to both, you can see where they're going up or down.
And so there are mechanisms for dealing with version change.
Can I just clarify that, Ms. Holmes? So, with Overseer FM, the current subscription model, the file for each farm or operation that is being assessed under that keeps all previous iterations or applications of the model for the data. we'll leave that to the privacy
committee.
So, and Kit, even after the subscription ends, that's interesting.
Thank you. Just on that, Dr. Crystal, I understand from talking to him that my assistant advisor outside this process that farm systems advisors also keep the information for a certain number of years if they've assisted a farmer. Do you know about that?
No, I don't.
Now, if we can turn to your rebuttal evidence, please. So, in policy 1E of the planning document, Ms. Mara has suggested that the words requiring timely implementation of FEPs be changed to requiring implementation of FEPs within 8 years of Plan Change 1 becoming operative. And at this part of your evidence, you say that you consider imposing a fixed time period like the 8 years suggested by Ms. Mara could lead to perverse outcomes and act as a disincentive to farmers proposing more costly and permanent measures in EVPs. And then you go on in paragraph 68 to say, I would be concerned that implementing the 8 year deadline proposed by Ms. Mara would reduce farmer engagement with and that enough efficacy of the EVP. However, you're not opposed to the inclusion of timeframes in principle, provided the EVP remains a living document. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of the requirements of Schedules D1 and D2 would not require, and if we set aside fencing, which has a particular time period associated with it, would not require any substantial outlays in terms of capital cost that would mean that those should be deferred beyond 8 years.
Can I please clarify what I think?
Absolutely.
So I'm not suggesting that they should be deferred beyond 8 years. I believe a FEP is a living document and it should continue. It's kind of like watering, you never finish. It just goes on forever.
Or waiting.
Yeah, waiting. So you're constantly, you put in your actions and then you will have a time frame for those actions. And it might be immediately, it might be 12 months, it might be 6 months. What I didn't want was that you have an end date and you say, great, I'm finished, I've done all the improvements, I'm perfect, I can just sit back. Because there is always more that you can do. And so I'm not suggesting that the time frame is greater than 8 years, I'm just suggesting that we don't have an end date. So you put in those mitigations and it might be immediately I can implement only heading cattle in this paddock during the low risk times of the year, etc. Not that I think those things should go beyond 8 years, just that we don't. This is a living document and it never ends. And I didn't want the impression that you're finished.
Okay, now I understand that, and that relates to some questions that Ms. Cooper asked her about the nature of FEPs and that it's a document that is very tailored to each farm and that the farmer has to buy into. But we have a dilemma here, don't we, because Schedule D2 talks about prioritising actions and appropriate specified time periods, but and that's at the commencement of Schedule D2. But the policy framework then talks also about appropriate specified time periods in policy 2, and says in determining the appropriate specified time period, include considerations of the following matters, and there are four. And the intention to achieve interim target states is one of four matters. Other matters include reasonably practicable and the scale of recent investment, etc. So the concern of Fish and Game is there's nothing really to say that the actions in Schedule D2, a farmer could choose to undertake those actions in 15 years.
I've done a comparison with the freshwater farm regulations, and my understanding of that is that with all your actions you have to have a time that is going to be achieved, and then you're limited on that, and that certification occurs. So actually it's not just the farmer that's the certifier, so perhaps I'm naive, but I believe that I don't think that the certifier, and I don't think that farmers are wanting to push these out. I actually do think that the processes there with the certification and the auditing process to ensure that these actions are occurring as soon as is practicable.
I know that your reference to the FEP is a living document, and I'm wondering if the solution might be that the portion of the FEP that is required under PC1, according to either schedules D1 or D2, needs to be completed within a certain number of years. Ms. Maris has suggested 8. But the remainder of the FEP, say the farmer wants to do some additional actions or has something planned in the future, does not need to comply with that time frame? Or is that?
So on the top, when I look at, say, D2, these are all things for nutrient management and the principles. These are defined actions, so to speak. And so if you said you have to do these things by 8 years. Well, actually, this is ongoing. This is ongoing to
But I think you said in your evidence that some of it you would just do immediately, like monitor soil phosphorus levels and maintain a meter of the agronomic optimum. Things like that you would just do immediately. I think what Fish and Game is asking for is for the identification of things that you might defer beyond 8 years, because
so I guess in terms of beyond 8 years, there's two factors, and one is going to be cost, and the other is going to be where does that come in my list of priorities or list of risks that I've got when I make the top of them. The other thing, so that's going to have an impact. The other thing with those rankings is that you get a storm event and a cold culvert blows out, and that actually, you know, comes to the top, so that's kind of the active. I do think it's a question. I'm not sure that I can see any. There are so many that you can do straight away, immediately, and then the others, it is going to be those larger, more expensive ones that are going to go to.
Okay, thank you. But this plan essentially does rely on FEPs, doesn't it, to get to the 10-year targets?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, my final topic is the stock exclusion provisions in Schedule C. And I would ask you to refer again to the Fonterra Dairy New Zealand Beef Land and Federated Farmers version that was handed out by Mr. Mahina. And so In 5C of that version, for land with a slope greater than 10 degrees, the bed of any permanently or intermittently flowing river greater than 1 metre wide, at any point in a paddock, is to be fenced, or at least, sorry, stock to be excluded. And then there are some exceptions there, and I asked Mr. Willis about this, and one of the exceptions is that, it's been certified in writing, and this is at the end of this provision, this page, sorry, that fencing of any intermittently flowing river is not practicable, and the measures proposed in the FEP will achieve the outcome set out in the policy. So, you've had a discussion with Ms. Toomai about the tension between certainty and flexibility in some of these provisions. Is it possible to provide a list of the circumstances in which it wouldn't be practicable? And I know that the farming sector has talked about obstacles. It just appears quite open-ended at the moment.
Are you asking me to provide a list now? Yeah. So, yes, I guess it is possible to provide a list. It would be exhaustive, and if that's where I struggle with listing, say, GMPs or whatever, because if your situation is on that list, then it doesn't count. But I do think that you could be examples provided.
Thank you. I should say that that fishing game doesn't really have provisions. But, and I noted that in these provisions, compared to the beef and lamb planning provisions filed, it no longer specifically refers to the use of troughs and shading within a paddock. Now it says, and the measures proposed in the FEP will achieve the outcomes set out in the policy. I assume that's intended to refer to those sorts of measures.
Yes, and time of year, stock, class, those sorts of things.
So with regards to the use of troughs and shading, in the more formal joint witness statement, I noted that Mr. Allen and Wright Stowe did not agree that there are further practical methods that can be objectively considered to achieve a comparable outcome to keeping stock out of a stream to fencing. This is 401.0087 of the bundle. And the types of methodology suggested are highly subjective and variable and generally impossible to audit. And in their opinion, provide an easy pathway to avoid stock exclusion being required. The literature on the use of shade and troughs and the extent to which that means that cattle will avoid water bodies is inconclusive, isn't it?
Yes, and I think that comes to the word comparable. This is the word that comes.
Please explain.
So I completely agree that comparable, so the best thing that you can do in most situations is to fence off a water body. And if we have all the contractors and all the money in the world, then let's do that. However, we're not in that situation, and so we need to prioritise, and there are other measures that we can do until we're at the situation where it is practicable to fence a certain area. And so there are things that you can do to minimise the risk of contaminant loss when you're in a situation that fencing is not practicable.
Yeah. Just finally, I read in your evidence that in some of these cases it may be better to have another priority action other than fencing that may achieve minimising contaminant losses, and I'm not just thinking here of shade and stock trees, but you might put that funding into, say, managing your ephemeral watercourses, and you talk about bunding and sediment traps and things like that. But this is the one tool, isn't it, in this plan that can address a multitude of benefits for water quality, and that should be standardised amongst farmers in terms of equity.
I really feel that at an individual farm level, you need to address the risk areas for that farm and understand the highest risk area. And so, for example, you may have your farm might be one of the farms identified in Dr. Dupree's evidence where a significant amount, so I can't remember the percentage, but a high percentage of sediment comes from 1.3% of the catchment. So in effect, it's a critical source area of the region rather than a critical source area of the farm. And for that farm, perhaps putting that money into pole planting is going to achieve far greater outcomes and all more the farms that, you know, than fencing as in when that farm is, you know, using the same farms. And so I do believe that in a lot of cases, yes, fencing is probably going to be, will be the highest risk in the first action that is undertaken, but it really needs to be done at that individual farm level and looking at the risks of that property.
Thank you, Dr. Christine.
Thank you, Ms. Holden. Ms. Ford?
Good morning, Dr. Christo. I'm Louise Ford for Horticulture New Zealand. Firstly, I just wanted to touch on some questions from Mr. Conway on Overseer. Talking to Mr. Conway, you said that the level of the uncertainty from the model itself relates back to whether or not there was field data to generate the equations or extrapolate it out. And then the Waikato for dairy and free draining soils in particular, that level of accuracy is greatest in that small subset. And that's not the case for commercial vegetable production, is it?
No, absolutely not.
So there's still quite a level of uncertainty with Overseer for CDP?
Yes, and perhaps I should say that when I am talking about the use of Overseer, I was specifically relating to New Zealand for Overseer.
Thank you. I'd like to move to your examination, your statement of evidence. You probably don't need to go to it, but we can if we do. You talk about inherent vulnerabilities in the statement, and that means the risk to freshwater and freshwater ecosystems from the biophysical features of land. And so that can, in your statement, you say that that could be drainage or irrigation, as well as slope and erosion effects.
Yes.
In soil type?
Yeah. Just to confirm, irrigation will be more of a management rather than a field.
Okay, thank you. But yeah, so climate, slope, that sort of thing. And you also say in your statement that the most recent council version of PC1 adequately addresses the inherent vulnerabilities of the land to diffuse nutrient discharges in schedules D1 and D2.
Yes, because they now refer to the freshwater farm plan, which does incorporate inherent risk.
and you're aware that commercial vegetable production farm environment plans must comply with the freshwater farm plan regulations?
Yes.
And so would it be fair to say that the inherent vulnerabilities of commercial vegetable production are addressed through the freshwater farm plans? You take it from me that the freshwater farm plan would address those inherent vulnerabilities and comply with Schedule D2,
yes.
Then that would be addressed.
Yes.
I now want to talk to you about E. coli. So you said at the start of your evidence that you back calculated your bar graphs from the pie charts in the Jacobs Sands report.
Yes. Yes. So no, literally just taking the area and dividing. So
did you refer to the source data from that report?
Yes, so that's from Samantha Davis.
And did you use the source data to then back calculate, or just from the pie graphs?
So it was so I and somebody else did for me. It was literally just from the pie graphs. So all we're doing is representing the data that's provided in those pie graphs in a different format. We haven't done anything else to the data.
And those and the bar graphs show some relatively unexpected E. coli results, correct? And you were surprised by those results?
I was surprised by those results.
Why?
So, because there were quite high E. coli results from the horticultural sector. And obviously E. coli is correlated with more ruminants, so we would expect to see that from the livestock sectors for the urban areas.
So the literature says that it's much less likely for E. coli to be discharged from commercial vegetable production land compared to dairy and dry stock. And you don't focus on horticulture or commercial vegetable production, you're either upset?
No, not at all. And the reason for using that data set was simply to compare, I was asked to compare the main pastoral sectors. And so that was the reason for using that data set, and simply because the others were there.
So would it be fair then that potentially the safer course of action for the court in regards to horticulture alone, that it might be better to rely on the Sands report data graph rather than
No, because it's literally exactly the same data. So there is a Sands report. It is exactly the same data. It's just represented in a bar. So I suspect that by looking at a bar, and this is one of the issues with data, is that you need to look at a number of ways to sense check it. So actually, I think we should go back to the Sands report and question some of the colonizers in the Sands report, because those bar graphs have highlighted that, well, actually, we don't think that it is coming from horticulture. And I suspect, I'm not a horticulture scientist, but I wouldn't want to say that a ton of loads are inaccurate, but I suspect that the partitioning of those loads to a land use is where you might want to look, but
that data
is identical to the Sands report.
So, just to be clear though, that you looked at the data that was represented and the numbers that were shown in the pie charts,
yes.
and not going back to the original numbers from the source data. And that source report was, you're aware of the source report. And you're aware that Ms. Sands, who authored the report, will be giving evidence for Birdwatch New Zealand. Ms. Sands will be giving that report in a different capacity, but the author will be here to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ford. Do you have any questions for the chair, Ms. Ferguson?
Yes, I do, sir.
All right, we'll take the